Okie dokes. Hey, how you doing, my friend?
Yeah.
All right. Reggie, ready to go? Good, 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 good. Me too. Feeling funky. Feeling good. All right, let's do this podcast, as they say. I don't even know why they're called podcasts anymore. I mean, these are pretty much now, you know, they're almost on regular television now. They're semi. Most of them are video. Mine isn't video. I'm old school podcast, Reggie. I adhere to the original idea of the podcast, which is a computer driven. In the several years that I've been doing this, the acceptance and the technology and everything else has changed. Now podcasts are all video. They're mostly dominated by celebrities, like TV shows, since most celebrities can't get TV shows anymore on regular television. Network television certainly isn't going to give it to them. And, you know, so anybody who's got a name of any kind goes to and runs to do a podcast now, as well as people's grandmothers and people's uncles and aunts and cousins and children and toddlers and cats. Yeah, wow. Who would have thought that human beings like to be noticed? Hey, I'm not putting myself up above anything else here, Reg, believe me. But there used to be some kind of discernment. There used to be some kind of a filtering out. That's gone. That's over with. So anyway, here I am podcasting the old school way, as if it was actually a real kind of a broadcast, trying to provide interesting, thought-provoking, fun, entertainment, also providing a little mystery. That's what radio was all about, Reggie. I know that you're a younger person. You probably don't even know what I'm talking about. But that used to be kind of the cool part of radio, was that you didn't know who these people were. You just heard their voices, and you concocted some kind of personality. You certainly kind of concocted what they may have looked like. They felt, if the good ones feel like they're talking to you, you feel very close and personal relationships. The human voice is a very intimate instrument, and I think that was the beauty of radio. And sadly, now radio is taking a back seat, and podcasts are now all the rage, and they're basically, you know, America's home videos. Except now everybody's doing it. Not just parents that get hit in the crotch by their young kid who throws a ball at them, like it was back in the 90s with Bob Saget. So, anyway, it is what it is, but we do this because hopefully we've got a nice, loyal audience that maybe appreciates the genuineness and the authenticity of this podcast in its true definition sense. How's that, Reg? Wow. You got a free speech for nothing right there. I should have saved that for the podcast. No one's ever going to hear that. But you just think about what I said. You're enough of an audience for me. All right, my friend. Put it in the books. 457. 3S's star smile strong. Now, hopefully I have something else to talk about here. I kind of blew my load right there before we even officially started the podcast and you started even recording. So now I've got a mission. Bring that same passion to the podcast that you did to the pre-podcast discussion that nobody ever hears with Reggie. All right, here we go. Star Smile Strong, 3, 2, 1. Hey, it's Elton Jim Toronto, and this is Captain Podtastic. And welcome to another episode of Elton Jim's Captain Podtastic. Every Monday, a new episode is posted at WGNRadio.com or wherever you go to find your favorite podcast. We are there. And don't forget to rate and subscribe to this podcast. But most importantly, don't forget to get out there and spread the word. Tell your friends, tell your family, tell anybody who listens to a podcast, which is now about almost everybody. I didn't say everybody who has a podcast. Everybody has a podcast. I don't know how many people listen, but almost everybody has one. But for those few people that just listen and don't do one themselves, tell them that yours, your favorite one is this one. Elton Jim's Captain Podtastic. It's your favorite, and it should be theirs too. Your loyalty and devotion and good wishes are much appreciated. Yeah, that's right. I threw the good wishes in this time. If you like what you hear, don't forget, there's many, many more of these just floating out there in the podcast universe waiting for you to load them down and listen. So go to WGNradio.com, go to the podcast section, hit the prompt for this podcast, and there they will be, dating back several years, week after week after week after week after week. Load more, scroll down, load more, scroll down. Load this one, number 457. So, here we are in the dog days of winter, getting ready, hopefully. I know the groundhog, I don't know what the official groundhog saw, I can't remember already, that was a month ago, Poskatunky, whatever the heck his name is, Phil. I don't know if he saw it. I know the one here in Illinois and Woodstock, they do a big thing because the film Groundhog Day was filmed in great part in Woodstock. So they certainly celebrate Groundhog Day now as kind of the unofficial spot. It's always in Pennsylvania. Punskatani, I don't know what Phil comes out. I don't know if he saw his shadow or not. Which if he does see his shadow, we got six more weeks. If he doesn't, it's going to be coming soon. I don't know. Right now in the Chicago area, we're in the depths of a really deep freeze for about a week or so, with some of the coldest temperatures we've had in a long, long time, in many years. Temperatures at the zero mark or one or even below zero, and wind chills reminded me of the good old days in the 70s and early 80s. In my day, winter was friggin' cold, and you had to wear a snorkel coat, parka with a big snorkel that you bought from Sears, and you liked it, and your hands got all frozen, and you had to wear long underwear, and you had to wear gloves and mittens and scarves and snow suits and galoshes, and you went out and you played in the cold and the snow for hours, and we liked it. We loved it. Yeah, now we're not used to this. Here in Chicago, once again, we're missing snow. We've had trace amounts. We usually get, 40, 50 some inches. At least we used to. Sometimes we used to get 90 inches. Craziness. Now I don't even think we've had 15 or 20. And I love the weathermen because they're all depressed. The winter is usually their Super Bowl. They get to, scare everybody and get into all these weather systems with snow. I mean, in the summer they get to scare you too with the heat. But the difference is that some people like heat. Some people say, hey, bring on the heat. 95, 100, that doesn't scare me. I don't care. Yeah, I mean, there's some health concerns for some people that have, kind of existing things. But for the most part, it's the winter that I know some people like the cold, but it does hamper life in some ways. It certainly, heavy snows can slow down traffic and create hazards and bitter cold. Yes, you can get heat stroke. There's no question about that, and sunstroke in the summer. But in the winter, you can get frostbite a lot quicker, I would think, at least. But it's a little more oppressive. Now, from my standpoint, it's no more or less oppressive. I am not a big heat like real hot heat guy. So to me, when it's 95 out, it's just as miserable as if the temperature is zero with 30 below wind chills. You know, I'm in the middle kind of guy. I like a nice 75. 75 during the day with some sun, maybe 80, maybe 80 without a lot of humidity. I'll take an 80. And then like a 55 or even a 50 at night. Ah, yeah, that's my weather. So, you know, the winter or the summer when those extremes happen. But, yeah, the weathermen have been kind of, at least they were, like, you know, this winter is we're inching up now on the end of February. And certainly we can get some snow in March, and we have some major snow here in the Chicago area and around the Midwest. But it doesn't usually, we maybe get one storm like that, and then it starts to get warmer a little, and then the ground warms up, and even if it snows, a lot of times it melts on its own quickly. So if you can make it through September or even the first or second week of March without a major dump of snow, you've probably escaped the winter, you know, without it. And I think that we're certainly on course. The temperatures are not that cold anymore. It's rained a few times. I don't remember it ever raining in the winter here. Once again, you know, 40, 50 years ago, when I was a little kid or in my teens and 20s, I mean, I never remember it raining in the winter. It just snowed. It was always cold. And so if there was moisture, it was snow. And, you know, we've had some rains here over the past months, but that's all it's been. Just not cold enough. But anyway, I'm not sure how the hell I got onto the weather. But it is funny. The weathermen are like kind of depressed. The weather people are kind of depressed. Like, oh, man, we haven't, you know, this snow just keeps missing us. It's like, yeah, that's good. What are you complaining about? No traffic, no hazards, no car crashes, no injuries. But that's not what I want to talk about today. What I want to talk about is I've said many times on this podcast, we love any kind of anniversary with a zero or a five. We really like the zeros. The fives are okay, but the zeros, we love the zeros. We love a 10, a 20, a 30, a 40, a 50, a 60, a 70, a 100, a 300. We love a zero milestone with any kind of number in front of it. We love it. The fives aren't bad, but they're kind of a halfway point to the next zero. We've got a big zero coming up, no pun intended, next year in 2026. Are you aware of that? Next year, 2026, 250th anniversary of this country. Some of us remember and are old enough to have been around for the bicentennial 50 years ago when we were 200. That one seemed cooler because there was two zeros and it has a cooler name, you know, bicentennial. I'm not sure what we're going to call it, if the 250 even has a number to it. I'm sure it does. I could look it up, but anyway, yeah. Do you realize that next year, 2026, 250th anniversary, 4th of July, is going to be a huge deal. Strap in. If the producers of Hamilton are smart, I think I would start a little revival of Hamilton for next year. I think I would do that. I think I would do that. I think Lynn, I can't even remember his name now, Lin-Manuel, he should, you know, he just put on the Hamilton waistcoat recently. Yeah, I would think about that. If you're a marketing guy, somebody should be doing Hamilton, whether it's a touring company or you know, the original cast. I wouldn't be surprised if that's already in the works, as they say. But yeah, so we love a anniversary with a zero and a five, and a landmark television show is celebrating its 50th anniversary in 2025. And I don't know if you must have been under a rock if you weren't aware of it. Maybe you were under a 30 rock. Oh, nice, Jim. Yeah, think about that one. You'll get it. If you have been completely out of the pop culture world here at all, then maybe you aren't aware. But 2025 is the 50th anniversary of Live from New York. It's Saturday Night. Saturday Night Live. First premiered on October 11th, 1975, making this the 50th anniversary. I'm not sure. Now, this baffles me. Why are they celebrating the 50th anniversary? They just did this big blowout, which I want to talk about, not only the show itself, the big anniversary celebration. They had several shows, actually, as well as the importance and meaning of the show on its own merits, lasting 50 years. But what I'm not sure of is why we are celebrating the 50th anniversary in February as opposed to October, when the show originally premiered in 1975 to make it a true 50th anniversary. You know, I'm not really sure why they decided to do that. I mean, you know, traditionally, I understand that, you know, right now is kind of a television standpoint. If you're a TV network, now is kind of a letdown time, you know. You've got the football is the and I'd already talked about this the last couple of weeks. You know, football has become such a dominant, sport as well as television programming. It's as I said many times here, the bonding event of the year for people. 115 million people, I mean 125 million people watch the game. So once that's over, there's this kind of a quiet period. You know, football every week, you know, from September to February, almost every week. And then there's this downtime. Yes, we have basketball. Yes, we have hockey. But you know, it's not the same. I know people love the NBA. People love college basketball. There's, you know, the whole March Madness coming up with college basketball. I get that. But in terms of, and that's a sporting thing, though. But if you're just in the general world here, in the Super Bowl, as I said, has become a mainstream event. It's kind of a downtime. You know, it's still kind of cold, and it certainly is. People are hibernating. So not a lot happening. So maybe that's why NBC said, look, you know, to carry us through this kind of down period in programming, maybe we'll get these big kind of tentpole events, you know, celebrate the anniversary at the beginning of the year as opposed to more at more appropriate time when the show started in October. 50 years ago. And so maybe that's the case. I don't know why they did it. It seemed a little strange, but it doesn't matter. That was their decision, and they decided to do it. And so we celebrated it. Now, I don't know if they're going to do something again on October 11th or close to it when the actual 50th anniversary happens. Just looking at a calendar here, I see that here in 2025, ironically, This drives me even crazier now. This drives me crazy. I didn't even look this up until right now. Just talking to you. Once again, the beauty of this podcast, totally off the top of my head for the most part. I know I tell you it's very scripted. That's a joke between you and me. But I've been baffled by all this Saturday Night Live celebration in February when the actual 50th anniversary should be celebrated on October 11th. 2025, which literally would be the 50th anniversary of that show. And now as I look at a calendar for October of 2025, you couldn't ask for anything better. October 11th falls on a Saturday. They could have, and so now I'm wondering, are they going to do like a Wicked thing here? You know, part one comes out last year, and now we got to wait for part two. So are they going to do something even crazier now on October 11th, the true 50th anniversary, after this big, they've had so many events, at least two or three major television and live events, a music documentary of all the musical people that have appeared on Saturday Night Live over the last 50 years, then a live concert from Radio City Music Hall, which featured many people, both older acts and younger acts who have appeared on the show, as well as contemporary acts. And then, of course, the big blowout, the official 50th anniversary celebration, which brought back all the cast members. I believe there's more than 800 people have been cast members in the last 50 years. Many of them have gone on to great fame and have become the comedy stars of the last 50 years, which is what I want to talk about. But my point is, so I wonder now when I see that October 11th, the day that Saturday Night Live premiered in 1975, is a Saturday. So I maybe we're not done yet. I'm just wondering now, because that's too perfect. You know, we'd be like, oh, well, you know, it's on the, you know, I didn't know what day it was on. So maybe, well, it's the 9th or the 12th, so we couldn't really do it exactly, blah, blah, blah. No, there's got to be some other, you know, I'm not a conspiracy theorist, but I was a former PR guy, and there's no coincidences, so we'll see what happens here. But, okay, let me get that out of the way. I don't understand why they did it now. But now I'm wondering if there's another master plan, something, you know, they have to do something to commemorate that show. And so maybe they wanted to get all the hoopla out, and then maybe they're going to do something real special on October 75 or October 11th to celebrate the actual, literal 50th anniversary. Wow, it's falling exactly on the same date 50 years later. That's too perfect. And I know that Lorne Michaels, who is an entertainment impresario, there's no way he's letting that go by without something. And neither is NBC. So we'll see. But I think it was interesting for those of us who are old enough to have been around for the first episode, and I do remember watching it. I was a young kid, but I was way into television. I've told you that many times. I was watching television at a very young age, so I was a little ahead of my peer group. In terms of music and movies and television. And so I do remember watching that. I do remember not understanding a lot of it, but I do remember watching it because they made such a big deal. This new show is going to be on. And I do remember watching the show. As I said, I admittedly didn't really understand it. The funny thing for me is, I heard of George Carlin, but very barely. I mean, I was a little kid. But I was way into music. And the two original musical guests were Janis Ian, who had a big hit at the time at 17, which I still think is a great song. And Billy Preston had just had a number one song as well with Nothing from Nothing, which was one of my favorite songs. I had both of those 45, those vinyl 45s at that time. Even though I was a little kid, I was way into the music and way into the radio. And so what really drew me to watch the first episode ever of Saturday Night Live, even as a little kid, was to see Billy Preston and Janis Ian perform their songs. I didn't know what Saturday Night Live was about. I didn't know what improv comedy was. I mean, I certainly watched, variety shows, and they were sort of selling this as a variety show aimed at a youthful audience. But it was not me. I was a little kid. This show was not aimed at me. As it progressed, it was aimed at me as I grew older. But it was aimed at, you know, the true baby boomer people who at that time were in their, you know, late teens or mid 20s, you know, basically aimed at the people that were born, in my view, the true baby boomers, if you're going to use that term, said this many times. For me, I know they love to do these 25 year generational things, and that's how they break it up, but I don't think those are very, I don't think they're very accurate. Because 25 years, if you're born at the tail end of one of these demographical cutoff points, you don't have a lot in common with the people that were born 25 years before you, and yet you're in that same group. You know, I think they usually do it like, you know, say 20 years, you know, is a generational thing like that. So they go from 1945 to like 1964. Well, I mean, somebody that was born in 1964 wasn't even around, you know, for World War II. They don't understand that. For me, the true baby boomer generation, where the term came from, are the babies that were boomed. There was a boom in babies when the male soldiers, mostly in World War II, it was males who were the soldiers in those days, came home from war. They had been gone for 2 or 3 or 4 or 5 years. When they came home, if you know what I mean, there was no denying what was going on when Johnny came marching home. Hurrah, hurrah. Okay? The proof is in the pudding. The stats show. There was a lot of babies born in those 5 years after World War II or so. So I really believe that if you're a baby boomer in the true sense, you're somebody that was born between 1945 and, I would say, maybe, you know, I'll even go out 5 years and say, you know, in 1950, maybe 51. But that's the most. That to me, it was the baby boom. The boom of babies, of people that were born in the aftermath of World War II. If you really want to look at it, you probably shouldn't even extend it out 5 years. Because by 1950, we were already in a different war again. We were in the Korean War. So, but yeah, so I'd look at anybody born between 1945 and 1950 as truly a baby boomer. And that's who the show was aimed at. Because by 1975, those people, you know, born in, say, 45, 46, 47, 48, 49, 50, by 1975, they were in their mid-20s. And they were beginning to take, you know, and these numbers were so big because so many babies were born that their influence had some real impact on the society. And you cannot deny the influence that the baby boomer generation has had. And so here was a show that was aimed at that age group, which was radically different than their parents in terms of everything. Music, perspective, humor, attitude, priorities, values. Saturday Night Live, it's kind of hard for people that, and there's 50 years of people now, but I'm sure that, for anyone that's even not even, that's younger than even 50, it's hard to really understand, because in your lifetime, if you're younger than 50, even 55, you have only seen the results of some of the influences of things that happened. A lot of people say, once again, a lot of younger people go, well, what's the big deal about the Beatles? Enough with the Beatles. Their songs aren't that great. I don't know what all the fuss is about the Beatles. Well, the only way to understand what the fuss was about the Beatles is you have to understand the context of when they arrived and what the norm was at the time. The norm at the time in music and even in the culture was very tame. You had the heartthrobs like Frankie Valli or Frankie Avalon and Fabian. The music was very tame and genteel and dreamy and quiet that even your parents could appreciate. And when the Beatles came in with this throwback to the Elvis era and the throwback to the Little Richard and the early days of rock, which had calmed down, and most people thought that rock was already dead, especially because Elvis had left the scene when he was drafted in the late 50s, and the Beatles brought it all back, and they just crashed the whole thing. And then everything since that has been influenced by it. But when they came on, it was a radical difference. So people look at Saturday Night Live, and they say, well, what's the big deal? Well, you have to understand, and even if you ever watch the first episode, which I'm sure you can see, and they replayed it a few weeks ago on the Saturday night before the actual big event special. If you see it in today's terms, it's funny. There's some funny moments, but you look at it and you say, well, what's the big deal? It's kind of tame. It's not outrageous. Believe me, I was a little kid, but I know it was outrageous because the norm at that time on television was once again very tame. It was a throwback. Yeah, there were variety shows, but the variety shows were they didn't feature rock and roll, and if they did, it was kind of like as a specialty. There certainly was no drug humor. It was almost vaudevillian. It was a throwback to the old, baggy pants farces with really corny jokes. That's why the Smothers Brothers show was so controversial, because that was one of the first ones, really. Saturday Night Live owes its lineage to the Smothers Brothers show, really. And many people that worked on that show later, became, it's something to do with Saturday Night Live. A few of them, Steve Martin was a writer on that show. Was never a cast member, but he certainly has played, that show helped him and his career, and he helped that show. They both kind of blossomed at the same time. But the Smothers Brothers became a very controversial show because it was all of a sudden anti-war. Many of the sentiments of the young people at the time that were viewed as radical and subversive by the mainstream media and the mainstream establishment of the culture and the government, they did not have a voice. And the Smothers Brothers gave them a voice. Those attitudes and those opinions, they gave those a voice and a representation on national television, which was unheard of at the time. And that's why that show didn't last very long. It had very good ratings, especially with young people, because they weren't just watching all these stars of the past who were refusing to give up the stage. In the 60s and the 70s, and even in 1975, there were still shows featuring George Burns and Bob Hope and Dean Martin and Jerry Lewis and Frank Sinatra and Bing Crosby. Nothing wrong with this. I think Bing died in 74, but still, nothing wrong with that. But those people had been around. Jack Benny, I think he died in 74 too. But my point is, from the late 60s to the mid-70s, it was still dominated by the people that had dominated the culture and the entertainment world from the 30s and 40s, from the radio days, the pre-television days. Those people were still around. There wasn't an influx of entertainment to reflect the younger generation and their views, their music, their perspective, their humor is completely different. What young people were talking about and laughing about and listening to and living was not really being reflected on television because the people producing the shows were older. And so they grew up with Bob Hope. And so it was still in this old kind of cornball, vaudevillian tradition where all those entertainers came from. And so when Saturday Night Live comes on, its humor was darker. It wasn't corny. You had to think a little. It was more satirical. It wasn't as much. There was slapstick, but it wasn't. It was almost slapstick in a way of parodying slapstick, whereas the vaudevillian tradition thrived on slapstick. It was a very common denominator kind of humor. You know, I mentioned before about, you know, America's Home Videos back in the 90s with Bob Saget. You know, the winning video on that show every week was some kid throwing a ball in his dad's crotch or something. We like pain. As long as we know that nobody's seriously hurt. You know, look at the Three Stooges. They made a career out of it. They never wore a Band-Aid. They never got cut. They never had a black eye. Right? So then it was okay for us to laugh at it. So when you had a show like Saturday Night Live that comes on and starts to do some kind of political humor with a bite to it, that's making fun of the current administration, that's talking about marijuana and drugs in a positive way, in a funny way, in a hip way. Whoa, that was unheard of. You know, I watched the first episode that was replayed, that it premiered on October 11th, 1975. And even now, 50 years later, I watched it and said, It was funny. It wasn't hilarious. I wasn't falling off my seat. It was a good variety show. It was exactly what it was supposed to be. It was a good variety show that really captured the moment from a young person in that time's perspective. But I think the reason that it was able to go on, even though the show was a little uneven and it wasn't always funny, but I think that the reason that NBC stayed with it was because it was still audacious. It was still brave and bold to do it. And the show, even though it was run by a bunch of young people in their 20s and 30s who hadn't really, you know, they were taking their step into the ring now
to try to knock off the Milton Berles and to knock off the Bob Hopes and to become the new generation. Very risky, very bold. As I said before, some of these people had had a hold on the entertainment world for the last 40 years. And they weren't going to go easy anyway. You know, they kind of laughed at the rock and roll generation of Elvis and the Beatles. And then things kind of calmed down again. And then all of a sudden it was okay, you know. You have to remember, the average variety show, I mean, that's what Saturday Night Live is. It's a variety show. It's got comedy and music. That's a variety show. Well, even at that time, in the early 70s, in 1975, the average variety shows, and there were many on television, still included the Carol Burnett Show, hugely popular. Things like Tony Orlando and Dawn, some incarnation of Sonny and Cher. People would have specials like Helen Reddy. These were mainstream, very safe acts. They weren't pushing any major, even though some of them were younger, like Sonny and Cher, the skits they did were still in that vaudevillian kind of mindset. Even a show like Laugh-In. People may not know what Laugh-In was. Laugh-In was a show that was on from the mid to late 60s to the early 70s, and it was supposedly, once again, aimed at the younger generation. As I said before, the Smothers Brothers Show and Laugh-In, both around the same time, the networks were trying to at least tap into this younger generation. But like Laugh-In, while they were trying to tap into the younger generation, the show was still kind of steeped in the old tradition. It was hosted by Dan Rowan and Dick Martin, who were older comics. They weren't young people. Now, as I said, the Smothers Brothers, to me, had credibility because they were younger. They were younger people at the time, so they were reflecting and really had a connection to and a passion for the music and the opinions and the passion of those times. Rowan and Martin, to me, seemed like they were taking advantage of it. You know, and if you watch, and there's a cable station called Binge, where they run old reruns of the Rowan and Martin's Laugh-In. And if you see it, yeah, you know, people are wearing mini skirts and Goldie Hawn is running around with bikinis with writing on her bodies and they're playing rock and roll and stuff like that. And they're talking about Vietnam. They're a little political. And so there's this little edge to it, which in 1968 was, once again, very controversial when, for the most part, you've got Dean Martin with Sammy Davis Jr. as a guest, and you've got Milton Berle and Bob Hope specials and Frank Sinatra specials and things like that. And all of a sudden, you've got Rowan and Martin doing this thing that's trying to be a little hipper. And there's young people in the cast, but the stuff they're doing is still very vaudevillian. It's a lot of slapstick. It's a lot of baggy pants farce, big goofy outfits, really corny stuff. The majority of the humor was still in the old tradition, but it was kind of being packaged in some kind of a cool hip thing. The sets were kind of cooler. There was some mod set designs and things like that. But but those were few and far between. There were times, you know, when Rowan and Martin, they were probably, now they look really young, you know, they look older. I'm not sure how old they were, but they were already established, you know, kind of old mindset. They weren't in their 80s, but they were probably in their late 30s or early 40s, which at that time, for the younger generation, was still considered old. So Laugh-In was revolutionary for what it did, but if you really take a close look at it, it wasn't as revolutionary as it pretended to be. To me, it was revolution packaged in a palpable way. There was enough of the hippie generation in it, more than the average show did to be sort of looking like it's cutting edge, but it was really dominated by, produced by, and starring by people that were still from the old tradition. So I really think that the Smothers Brothers was a more revolutionary network TV show. But my point is that Saturday Night Live was so different. As I said, drug culture. Janice Ian and Billy Preston were not really appearing on a lot of on the Helen Reddy specials, or on Tony Orlando and Dawn's variety show. You know, they would have Bing Crosby on or something. So I think the reason why Saturday Night Live, even though the first episode, you watch it and go, eh. But you have to understand, for the time, it was so different. And it's hard for people in today's world to understand that. You have to have the context. You really have to do some homework and see and understand what it was like at that time, to understand why some of these things that now are viewed as revolutionary in today's world seem tame, because what's happened is those shows, those artists, the Beatles, Saturday Night Live, they were so different and they changed the culture so quickly and so dominantly that everything that's come after it was influenced by it. And then it's taken things to another level and another level. So, for instance, one of the famous Saturday Night Live skits was Dan Aykroyd doing Julia Child, who, and maybe some people don't even know who Julia Child is. This is the problem. Julia Child is one of the first television cooks. Now there's a million cooking shows on TV, there's networks, everybody's doing cooking shows, right? But there weren't that many. In fact, there were none. Julia Child had to start on PBS. Networks weren't going to show somebody cooking. Then, of course, when they saw the popularity of Julia Child, then all of a sudden, there was the Galloping Gourmet, who became a sensation because he was on network television. But my point is, so Julia Child was a well-known chef at the time, still, but older woman, though. So not only was Dan Aykroyd doing a parody on this older woman, but, you know, she did this very genteel show that's there to show you how to cook. And the subversive comedy of Saturday Night Live, which is now commonplace, but it wasn't back then, 50 years ago or so. Dan Aykroyd's playing Julia Child, explaining how to cook something, and then she accidentally cuts her finger and starts to bleed profusely, but continues to do the cooking segment while this blood is pouring out of her hand, to the point where she's getting weak because she's losing so much blood. And at the time, it was hilarious. Not only because they chose this figure, Julia Child, who was very proper and established, and so Dan Aykroyd's doing an impersonation of her already, so that's funny. He's in drag doing that. He's already poking the bear from a satirical standpoint, but then it takes the humor to a different level. It takes the Three Stooges slapstick to a different level. As I said before, the Three Stooges, they never got a black eye. They never bled. They never broke an arm, even though they were getting hit with anvils. But in the new sensibility of the baby boomer generation's comedy, Julia Child cuts her hand and there's blood, so much so that she's bleeding to death. That's the difference. The Three Stooges never got hurt. They continued to move on throughout the show, even though they got hit by planks of wood and anvils on their head. They never missed a beat. But here, Julia Child, in this skit, is showing how to do something, cuts her hand, and bleeds to death. And that's the difference. So now, if you've seen Saturday Night Live over the last several years, one of the funnier skits was a couple of years ago, Martin Short at Christmas time was the host, and he played Scrooge. And he was throwing the gold coins to the kid to go get the turkey when he has this great revelation now, finally, of what the Christmas spirit is, and he throws a coin from his balcony, and it hits the little kid in the eye, and blood comes spurting out. And there's a whole series of disgusting decapitations and amputations and blood everywhere. It's a bloodbath. Scrooge is trying to be a nice guy by throwing these coins, but from up on the balcony, by the time they come down, they're impaling people, and it's a bloodbath. And of course, it's hilarious when you see it. Well, that's the difference. That's there. That skit, if you've seen the Martin Short skit, as him as Scrooge throwing the coins and impaling all these people and decapitating them with these coins, that is directly influenced by Dan Aykroyd's Julia Child from 50 years ago. Only now it's taken to an outrageous level. Dan Aykroyd was one person playing Julia Child, cut his hand, and it bled, and the blood was gushing out. They must have had some kind of a thing that was just, you know, the blood was all over the set, all over him, and he winds up dying. But it was just one person. And it was just the blood coming out of his hand. That was it. Fast forward 50 years. Once again, taking a well-known established thing, the Christmas Carol. But now it's a bloodbath with decapitations and amputations and blood everywhere. Because in 50 years, that's where comedy has moved. We've seen the horror movies with the disgusting blood everywhere, and now we've come to laugh at that. But from a comedy standpoint, that Martin Short skit in 2023, whenever it was, never really happens if Dan Aykroyd doesn't do Julia Child on Saturday Night Live in the 70s. And that's my point. So you look at that, you say, well, what's so funny about what's so crazy about this Julia Child thing? I mean, there's a little blood. That's not that funny. But at the time, Milton Berle and Bob Hope were not doing skits where people were bleeding like that. And Julia Child, of course, is bleeding and pretending and still going on with her thing. And so, oh, I seem to be bleeding here. But don't forget to keep stirring this, and you put the chicken in. That was the genius of it. So, you know, when we look back at these things, you have to understand the context and why they were so revolutionary. So, yeah, you know, unfortunately, it might take a little homework, but I think it's worth doing that homework because you'll then really appreciate it more. But sadly, today, nobody does the homework. We've got such a short attention span. We've got such a disdain, or not even a disdain. It's just an ignorance. It's just if it's not happening to me, once again, we're in such a look at me narcissistic society. If it's not happening to me or within my world, I don't care about it. That's the way most people look at things today. They think something 10 years ago is old. Like I said, I have a friend of mine that was a teacher, and I said, how do you teach kids that they think the show Seinfeld is old? And it is. It's more than 30 years old from when it first appeared. So, But you have to understand, well, why was that show so? Because in the 80s or in the 90s, there wasn't a show with that kind of a sarcastic and that kind of a dark view of the world on network television. Everything was cheery and fun. They had the wacky neighbor and the you know, it was the time of Home Improvement. And then this show comes around, and we've got three characters or four characters who are completely self-centered and selfish and rude and mean and are celebrated. So Saturday Night Live really was revolutionary, and Lorne Michaels, the producer and the creator of the show, does deserve credit to take a bow. I mean, if you think about it, Saturday Night Live has not only been on the air, it's got to be one of the longest shows in the history of television to be on for 50 years. And we should note that Lorne Michaels was not in charge of the show for all 50 years. There was a time when he was gone for about 5 years. But he gets credit for the 50. We don't think about those other years when Lorne wasn't there. Because he's been there for most of them. But really, the people that came out of Saturday Night Live did exactly what their goal was. This was a young, ambitious, driven generation, rebellious, who were saying, hey, it's our time now. Milton Berle and Bob Hope, you guys, you've had the stage for 40 years. Those days are over. We're going to talk about rock and roll music and drug references and concerts, and we're going to talk about you know, the war in Vietnam and how bad of a president Gerald Ford is and Richard Nixon and Jimmy Carter and you name it. There's no sacred cows. We're going to do gross stuff. We're going to do silly stuff. We're going to do slapstick. We're going to do it all. There's no filter here. And that was revolutionary. And out of that show and out of that spirit, so much of what has shaped our culture and certainly our comedy culture in the last 50 years can, for the most part, be traced back to Saturday Night Live. Not all of it, but a great, great, great percentage of it. I mean, when you think about it, really, really, you know, the show made a mark initially, and really, it shot a cannonball across the bow, because Chevy Chase won an Emmy that year for his appearance on Saturday Night Live after the first season. Sadly, he left, and he acknowledges he was stupid to leave after the first year. He went to become a movie star, and he really should have stayed on, because even though he did have a fine career, but I think he would have still had that career, but he would have probably done some amazing work on Saturday Night Live. He was really responsible in many ways, and worked very closely with Lorne Michaels at the time to put that show together. And it's unfortunate that he had more ambition than the show. And don't get me wrong, he had a very successful career, right? I mean, with Fletch, and now, my gosh, you know, the vacation movies, especially Christmas Vacation, has become an annual event. But I think from a comedy kind of credibility standpoint, if he would have stuck around with Saturday Night Live a few years longer, and maybe left when everybody else did, when Aykroyd and Belushi and Murray left by 1980, I think he would have still had the career that he wanted. But when you think about it, you know, John Belushi, Dan Aykroyd, the Blues Brothers, huge. Sadly, Belushi died. In fact, the anniversary is on March 5th, just a couple of weeks from now, in 1982 when he died. Very sad. I'll never forget that day. John Belushi was one of my heroes. But I mean, so the Blues Brothers had a number one album in 1978. the film, The Blues Brothers, was a classic at the time. As I said, whether Chevy Chase or not stayed with the show, he became a major star. Maybe not right away, but he ultimately has become a well-known star. But, I mean, think of the people that have come through there. You know, Gilda Radner, Bill Murray, and then, you know, Chris Rock, Eddie Murphy, Will Ferrell, Dana Carvey, David Spade, Chris Farley, Adam Sandler, Bill Hader, Dennis Miller, Norm MacDonald, Colin Quinn. I mean, wow. And, you know, and yes, and you know, I said Gilda Radner, Jane Curtin, they became stars in their own right on television and films. Of course, now most likely, you know, Tina Fey, Kristen Wiig, Maya Rudolph, Amy Poehler. I mean, the list goes on. Jimmy Fallon, host of The Tonight Show. I mean, from a movie standpoint, the last 50 years of films, is like some of those people. Will Ferrell has been in some of the biggest films of all time. Eddie Murphy, Chris Rock. You know, I mean, the names go on and on and on. That show has spawned basically the biggest stars and the most well-known stars of comedy in the last 50 years. Now, as I said, not everybody. Jim Carrey tried out, didn't make it. Steve Carell tried out, didn't make it. Which sounds crazy, right? But they became stars in their own right. So not everybody did. But there's no question that the influence that the show itself on literally the people that were on the show have had on comedy and our culture in general, in music, in comedy, in perspectives, as well as people that were then also influenced by it. Don't forget, even if you weren't on the show, if you were a comedian, you were watching it, and those people influenced you. So maybe you never got on it, but you were influenced by them. You cannot dispute and underestimate the success and the influence that Saturday Night Live has had on our culture, comedy-wise and overall, in the last 50 years. Now, granted, the show hasn't always been funny on every... It doesn't always hit. There's some skits that are not funny. There are some skits that run too long. But there is enough that show is done that it deserves to be applauded and honored. But it does bring up a question in my mind as well. Because while in my era, literally, I mean, once again, this is a time when we didn't, I know it's younger, it's hard for younger people to understand. We didn't have the option of watching it at a later time. When the show, it wasn't until the early to mid 80s that everybody had a VCR. You couldn't, if you missed a show that wasn't on, you didn't see it. There was no taping. There was no stream. You couldn't go back and watch. This, I know it sounds like it was the Stone Age, but that was true. It wasn't until the mid-80s when this whole idea of being able to record a show and watch it at a different time became a reality for us. And so... So what Saturday Night Live really did was changed the culture in, you used to, like when I was a young kid, like I said, the glory days of Saturday Night Live really happened in my lifetime in terms of when I was a little kid and then into the 80s And in the 90s, in my teens and 20s, and then even, you know, early 30s. But in my teens and early 20s, we still stayed home to watch Saturday Night Live. You wanted to watch it. Because that was a bonding experience, a shared memory, as I use this phrase, a shared memory, and you were talking about it. The show spawned catchphrases, making copies. I mean, things like that. You said not. There was things, you know, wild and crazy guy, all this stuff. You had to watch Saturday Night Live because on Monday, people were going to be talking about it. And you couldn't go. If you missed it, you missed it. So you had to watch it. Even if you went out with some friends, you watched Saturday Night Live and then you went out and did something. It was that influential. And it changed behaviors, not only perspectives, it changed humor, but it changed behavior, it changed the culture. It was groundbreaking. And every so often in our lifetimes, there are those things that were great ideas and perfect storms. The rise and the popularity and the influence of Saturday Night Live was a perfect storm. There was this emerging generation that was chomping at the bit to get their chance. They made their voices heard in the late 60s and early 70s as teenagers during the Vietnam War, and now they were in their mid-20s, and they were out in the world. They were getting jobs. They were getting positions of power. And they had and their numbers, the baby boom generation, was so big because, as I said, this huge birth explosion when the soldiers came back from World War II, that they had the advertising numbers to validate targeting these people with TV shows. Suddenly, advertisers wanted those people because now they were in the workforce, they had disposable income, and they were going to buy things. And they had the numbers to, if you had a product that appealed to them, you could make billions of dollars because those numbers were huge. And so it was the perfect storm. It was the time was right. You had an older generation that was hanging around a little too long. You had a younger generation that had a completely different perspective on things, who were chomping at the bit to get their views out there and get their time. And you finally had the climate in terms of the real world, the business world, to say, yeah, you know what? This group is worth catering to. That group was there 10 years before, even 5 years before, but they didn't have the spending power. They were still in college. They didn't have jobs. But by 1975, if they were born in 1950, they were 25. If they were born a little earlier than that, they were almost 30. They had jobs, they had money, they had disposable income, and they had the numbers in terms of population. So now they were an attractive target to go after. And if you say, wow, Jim, that really sounds pretty nuts and bolts. And well, that, you know what? I hate to tell you, I hate to break the facade, but that's the reality of things. Look at the internet. The internet now is a 100% money generating platform. That's all it is. It's about advertising and money, monetizing. And if you don't think that's true, then you're having the wool pull over your eyes. It may have started out as a communications device. Some unique kind of thing for information and communication, emails, finding out some facts. Started out that way. A quick, easy way to communicate with people and to get access to information quickly. Yeah, really high-minded kind of goals. But almost 30 years later, it is 140,000% a monetized entity, pure and simple. The richest people in the world are those who have been able to monetize the internet. Bill Gates, Mark Zuckerberg, Jeff Bezos, Larry Ellison. The internet is a business. The internet is not some cool little thing that we first thought it would have been 30 years ago. It's a main driver. The richest people in the world have all of their roots in technology and the internet. Apple. The biggest companies, the richest people in this world are tied to the internet. It's a money-making platform, pure and simple. And 50 years ago, television was that. And as I said, the reason why Saturday Night Live was even allowed to be on the air, well, it was a bold experiment by the people at NBC, there's no question. And a good movie to watch is this movie called Saturday Night that just is it's available on streaming now that Ivan Reitman's son, Jason Reitman, directed. It gives you a nice little background, a little history. I hope you see that. You might get an idea where you see that Johnny Carson was threatened by it, and Milton Berle was threatened by it because, well, who the heck are these young vagabonds who think they're going to be on television? I've been on television for 40 years. I know what people like. I'm the star. And pretty soon, they were toppled. And Johnny Carson was having on the stars of Saturday Night Live sitting in his chair, whereas before he was having Don Rickles and Joey Bishop. In terms of, so yeah, you cannot underestimate. Now, in terms of the show itself, these celebrations, yeah, there's no question. I remember watching the episode. I have not watched Saturday Night Live on a regular basis in probably 20 years, if not more. I don't think the show is funny. I know there's been some people that have come through there over the last 25 years, but I never watched them with maybe not 25 years, but I don't know. It's hard to tell. Certainly the last 15. The cast members have come and gone. I just don't think the show has that same kind of influence. It now, you know, like most rebels and most revolutionaries, Saturday Night Live has become the establishment, which is ironic. It started out as being this ragamuffin, this show, you know, put on by these unknown ragamuffin kids that don't even know what they're talking about in order to put a TV show. And now, 50 years later, they're the Milton Berles. They're the Bob Hopes. And there's young people today watching that show going, what the heck? I want my time in the sun. That show is old and tired. The show now does not look to break barriers or boundaries. The show today plays to a mass audience. It is, in fact, like a variety show of the 60s and early 70s, of which it rebelled against. It used to have people like Devo. I remember watching the first appearance of Devo in 1978. Fred Willard from Fernwood Tonight and so many other shows, Modern Family most recently, was the host. And I remember Devo coming out with these yellow hazmat outfits on in these big glasses, singing this techno electronic stuttering version of Satisfaction by the Rolling Stones. A total FU to the Stones in many ways. Just the way the Stones were an FU to Frankie Avalon, now in 1978 they were being given the finger to, in a way. Yes, it was a tribute, but it was also a way to deconstruct one of the landmark songs of the rock era into a new age, or at that time, the punk rock, new wave kind of music that was happening. I remember watching that and seeing Devo and going, what the heck is that? But also going, wow, what the heck was that? I ran out and bought the Devo album after that. I became a Devo fan. That first album is one of my favorite Devo albums, period. It's because I saw them on Saturday Night Live. In today's world, they wouldn't have a group, an unknown group like Devo on. Now the musical guests are Lady Gaga. Mainstream. The hosts are mainstream big stars. Timothy Chalamet. Ariana Grande, Scarlett Johansson. The early days of Saturday Night Live, they used to have unknown people like Buck Henry, who wasn't well known, but you know what? He was a co-creator of the Get Smart Show, funny as hell, but he hosted many times. They'd never have somebody like Buck Henry, the equivalent of a Buck Henry, hosting Saturday Night Live today, because they are the establishment now. Like so many rebels who change things, they become the establishment. Castro was a rebel in Cuba, and then he became more corrupt than the government that he took over from. He became exactly what he rebelled against. It happens throughout history all the time. The United States rebelled against the powerful England in 1776. And now what is America? They are the equivalent of the powerful England at that time. It's inevitable. Power corrupts. It's easier to find fault when you're on the outside than you are on the inside. And once you get in the inside and you find some success, human nature says you want to keep that power. You want to keep that success. And so you sadly lose a lot of those values that you once had that allowed you to get to that point. And Saturday Night Live is not the same rebellious, subversive, underground counterculture show anymore. It is the establishment show. It is the Bob Hope special of 2025. It is the Carol Burnett show of 2025. I'm sure Lorne Michaels would not be happy to hear that, but it is true. Saturday Night Live has become what it once rebelled against. But there's nothing wrong with that. That's the natural progression. As I said, I have great respect for Lorne Michaels and great respect for the show, but I haven't watched it in many years because I think it's lost its edge and it's become a mainstream show. And there's nothing wrong with that. I understand that. But it's not the rebellious kind of show, edgy show, that it once was. And it can't be. It just can't be. That's not the way it works. And that's why I was thinking at this time, there's been talk. I mean, Lorne Michaels has to be in his 80s by now. He's been involved with the show for the majority of its 50 years. And so there has been a lot of talk. Will Lorne Michaels leave the show? If you saw the 50th anniversary special, I think you saw what really helps to prove my point, that the best days of Saturday Night Live are in its past, not in its present. and probably not in his future. You saw some classic skits replayed. You saw some of the stars who came from that show to come back and do new skits or new versions of their classic skits. But you have to be able to cut through the nostalgia and appreciate what they were. Yeah, you know what? It was cool to see a new Debbie Downer sketch on that show. Yes. But it really wasn't as funny. It was cool to see Eddie Murphy and Will Ferrell in a skit together. Two of the biggest stars to come off of Saturday Night Live. Yeah, that's nostalgic to see these two superstars on television on the show that they got their start on. But it wasn't that funny. My gosh, when Will Ferrell did the imitation of Robert Goulet, I don't even know if anybody knew who Robert Goulet was. There's nobody in their 30s or 40s, even 50s, who even knows who Robert Goulet is. I mean, to me, that skit, you know, with the Kristen Wiig character with the little hands, that fell, that bombed. That and was way too long, as were many of the shows or the skits. Meryl Streep came on in a skit that went way too long. Yeah, it was nostalgic to see some of these actors come back and do some of their famous bits again or get into new skits. They were trying to be relevant. They brought Tina Fey and Seth Meyers, both people who've been on the show in the last 20 years, to head up that show and to be the head writers as well as other people. But I felt that the new skits really didn't work that well. I felt that there should have been, when they did show some old skits, you really appreciated what there were. And sadly, I know it's 3 hours, but to me, I think they were so intent on not looking back, but looking forward that they missed the mark on celebrating the history of the show. There were so many characters and so many stars that were not represented. Or if they were shown in quick montages that younger people wouldn't even, you know, older people got the references, but younger people wouldn't even know. Like I was just thinking about the other day, Billy Crystal's Fernando. You look marvelous. Now that character that Billy Crystal did in the mid-80s was huge. It helped put Saturday Night Live back on the map. It was dying. There was questions whether that show was going to last. And that was only 10 years after it was on in the mid-80s. There were questions of whether it could continue. After the original cast left, after the Aykroyds and Murrays and everybody left, that show was treading, that show was treading water. I had a couple of disastrous seasons. Where Robert Downey Jr. was a young actor on it and was horrible. The show was almost counted out. And in one season, one of the producers who is now in charge, Dick Ebersol, brought in some well-known names like Billy Crystal and Christopher Guest and Martin Short and Harry Shearer to help save the show because these people were major comedy stars. But the Fernando character was not even, there should have been a Fernando's Hideaway sketch. Billy Crystal's Fernando deserved to be represented there, and he wasn't, because we had these several way too long skits that were stunt casted and that were not going anywhere. I wouldn't have minded a few of those, but the show was dominated. And I understand, I know darn well that when they sat in the room, they said, we don't want to be, you know, Lorne Michaels still trying to be this anti, what it's not. Admit what you are. Admit you're the establishment and celebrate your history. They were trying to celebrate their relevance today. Well, we'll have some classic stars, but we'll write new skits to show that this is not just going to be a clip show. This is not just going to be some nostalgic thing. We're going to show them that we still can do it. We're going to have new skits. Well, you know what? It was a lot of time wasted where we could have appreciated some of the great things. And maybe even younger people could have appreciated some things that they maybe didn't see before or weren't aware of, and maybe they were could have been exposed to. But there was just quick montages and things like that. I give them credit for showing the Don't Look Back in Anger classic film from 1978 with John Belushi doing an ironic black and white kind of thing that he's the only remaining living original cast member, which ironically was he was the first to die. And he even says, they always thought I'd be the first to go. You know, live fast and leave a good-looking corpse. And sadly, that's what he did. So I give them credit for running that whole thing. But that wasn't enough. There were a lot of acts and a lot of skits and a lot of personalities and stars that did do some great things on that show that were bypassed. And a lot of times it was because of politics. One of the best Weekend Update people was Dennis Miller. But, you know, Dennis Miller now is considered a conservative, and so you didn't even see, I don't even know if I saw him anywhere. Bill Murray did mention his name on listing the best, some of the best Weekend Update hosts. But what I would have done, since, ironically, of the original cast, there's only two people that have passed away, Gilda Radner and John Belushi. But the others are still around. Well, Michael O'Donohue was a quasi-original cast member, and he has passed away. But Jane Curtin is still alive. Chevy Chase is still alive. Garrett Morris is still alive. Dan Aykroyd is still alive. And Lorraine Newman is still alive. I would have done, right in the middle of the show, I would have had a blackout stage. I would have them there. The lights would have gone up. And I wouldn't have even introduced them. I just would have let the lights go up on them, and the crowd would have went nuts. There would have been a standing ovation. It would have been tearful. If you saw at the end of the show, in like they always do at the end when they have the whole cast out there and they had everybody on stage that was even either in the show or on the show, I mean, it was huge, but Jane Curtin and Lorraine Newman had a picture of Gilda Radner right in the front so people wouldn't forget her. So tell me that wouldn't have been great to have the surviving cast members just standing on stage, not performing, not saying a word, just standing there and taking the bow that they deserved for being the people that started this all and that really were revolutionaries and changed comedy and change television. They deserve that moment. Now, maybe they'll have it again on October 11th. Maybe they're saving that for October 11th, which is a Saturday night. We'll see. So I can't be overly critical because maybe there's something planned for October 11th now that I know that it's on a Saturday that will fill in some of the blanks that I felt that show didn't have. But, and I also think that I wonder, as I said before, Saturday Night Live is such an establishment institution right now. And for NBC, it's too, even though the show doesn't have the impact, it doesn't have the ratings, it doesn't have the influence that it did, but it still has a brand. And so, if you're the NBC programmer, you don't have to worry about that time slot. Even though it's not pulling what it used to, at least it takes care of itself. It makes a profit, and it's established because if they were going to take Saturday Night Live off and put some new kind of a show in there, it would cost three times as much. And I'm getting down to business again, because that's what television is. It's a business, folks. I hate to tell you. It will cost three times as much for them to conceive a new show, to get it on its feet, and to promote it, and then keep your fingers crossed that it catches on. It might die a fast death, and now what do you do? Whereas, you know, even though Saturday Night Live isn't what it used to be, at least it will get a bare minimum of people, and I don't have to worry about filling that spot. But I really think that Saturday Night Live, as I said, now this is my own view. I haven't watched it in several years. I don't know any of the newer people. I just don't think it's funny. I think it's a different comedy, and maybe it's not aimed at me. Once again, I'm an older person now. I get it. I get it. It's not aimed at me, so maybe I shouldn't enjoy it. But when I look at some of the things that were great ideas at one time and are still trying to hold on longer than they should, I think, what a perfect time. After 50 years, it might be just the right time that Saturday Night Live says goodbye. I think it was a great, as I said, it was a perfect storm. It was a great idea for its time, but I don't think it's able to do that anymore. It's become what it parodied. It's become what it rebelled against. And we love anniversaries with zeros and fives. And now that I find out that, my gosh, the October 11th will be a Saturday night, wow, what a great way to go out. So many times people don't know when to leave the stage. Michael Jordan didn't know when to leave the stage. So many people keep hanging on longer than they should. Rolling Stone magazine doesn't need to be around anymore. It was a great idea for its time. Remember Playboy magazine? In the repressive Eisenhower generation or era, Playboy was a rebellious, audacious idea. But in 2025, it's tame compared to now that people can pull up porn on their computer with no problem. Any time of the day. You have to wait for the next issue of Playboy. And I just wonder, yes, you know, Saturday Night Live has a rich, rich, impressive, admirable, history-making legacy. But maybe it's time for it to go. Everybody's wondering, will Lorne Michaels retire? And if he does, who would take his place? Might Tina Fey and Seth Meyers become the head writers or the producers? Maybe they'll do it together, or maybe just one of them. I wonder if this 50th anniversary show was an audition to show NBC. You see, Lauren's saying, you know, if I go, I mean, the show got like 115 million or 15 million viewers. Not bad, especially in today's world. Jimmy Kimmel's show and those shows, they barely get 1 million. So 15 million people watched the Saturday Night Live show. So maybe the reason that they did this, like, we're going to put new sketches on and put Tina Fey and Seth Meyers at the head of it, was sort of an audition to show NBC that if Lorne goes, one of these two, or perhaps both of them, working together, can do this show and it could go on for another 15 or 20 years. I don't know. As I said, it's too tempting to leave it on, even though it doesn't have the same impact it used to, because it's at least reliable. But Saturday Night Live, at its essence, it wasn't conceived to be reliable. It wasn't conceived to be a safe bet. That's its history. It was a huge, audacious, bold, crazy experiment. And that's not what it is anymore. It's not its fault. That's what happens with time. So while I have the utmost respect for Lorne Michaels, My humor, some of my comic heroes, my heroes in entertainment, all came from Saturday Night Live. I watched that show religiously for, for the first 10 years and then on and off, then came back to it. But really, as I said, I haven't watched it now in a good 15, if not 20 years, I would guess. But I'm just looking at it from its own history. Sometimes, look at Seinfeld. Seinfeld could have went on for two or three more years. But Jerry Seinfeld said, you know what? I don't want to leave limping. I want to go out on a high note. The Beatles could have gone on, but they went out on a high note. And it's very tempting. But after 50 years, there's no, I mean, my gosh. I don't know. I don't think, you know, don't forget, television shows didn't really start until the late 40s. Television itself is only 80-some years old, really, when it became a real kind of thing where people had it in their homes, certainly in the 50s. So that's, you know, Saturday Night Live has been on 50 of the 80 years. There's been no other show that was on that long. But maybe it's time at 50. Maybe it's time with Lorne Michaels in his 80s to say we had a great run. I would have so much respect for Lorne Michaels if on October 11th, 2025, on a Saturday night, they did the show and he announced that the show would be ending. I think that would be a really admirable thing to do. But it's a business. It's an institution. And so we'll see. But I look back at Saturday Night Live and I know how it was important to my life for so many years. And I look back and to see how it has entertained me and the people that came from that show have entertained me and influenced me. And some have been my heroes. And so I have a great affection for it. And that's why, while I wish it a happy birthday, I also wish that it would go out on a high note. We'll see. Live from New York, it's Saturday night. And so ends another episode of Elton Jim's Captain Podtastic. Every Monday, a new episode is posted at WGNRadio.com or wherever you go to find your favorite podcast. We are there. And don't forget to tell your friends, tell your family, tell anyone who listens to a podcast that your favorite podcast is Elton Jim's Captain Podtastic, and it should be theirs too. Your loyalty and devotion are much appreciated. Hope you enjoyed episode number 457. I'm Jim Tirano. I ain't here on business. I'm only here for fun. You've been listening to Elton Jim's Captain Podtastic, from the end of my mind to your ears. The world of Reigns.